Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we meet composer, performer, and singer-songwriter Noam Feingold. Director of the Barthelmess Conservatory, he's an accomplished composer and conductor with work ranging from traditional orchestral and chamber music to new music to genre-bending music like his Burning City Orchestra, which combines an art song sensibility with alt-pop, rock, and chamber music influences. Here's an excerpt from their recent album released last fall, their self-named album, and a song titled Madam.
I guess that I fear being alone. The sand between my toes is so visceral. I had feelings that were never known. Still I can scream at the open sea and swear that no echo returns. I swim out sometimes, but eventually I'm back on the island I spurned.
That's the music of Noam Feingold and his Burning City Orchestra. He's also serving as curator for Living Arts of Tulsa's OK Electric Music Festival, coming up this Friday and Saturday at Living Arts. This year's festival lineup features live improvisational film music by Chris Combs, dramatic vocal works drawing from experimental opera and theater by Scott Wolschlager and Jared Hinkle, electro chamber music exploring beats and grooves with members of Tulsa's orchestras, and an Unknown Tone Records ambient music showcase, plus a lecture by my guest today, Noam Feingold. The OK Electric Music Festival takes place Friday and Saturday at Living Arts, and Noam joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Noam Feingold, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to talk about your new recording that came out a few months ago, but before we do that, let's talk about this OK Electric Music Festival. How did this festival come about?
Well, it's actually been going on for a little while now, and it's been kind of going back and forth between different curators, but it's something that Living Arts has been doing. I know that Living Arts has a history of bringing some very, very important musical thinkers into town throughout its inception from the late 60s and early 70s. I know we've had John Cage here, Paulina Oliveros, Meredith Monk, people who've sort of dabbled in electronic music a little bit, but for the most part are really just experimental artists who have contributed quite a lot to contemporary classical music culture, experimental art. In general, there tends to be a lot of multimedia overlap. These are really sort of thinkers whose work manifests specifically in music, are musically trained, but are not necessarily explicitly interested in music alone and are interested in the interrelationships between the different artistic fields.
And what was your approach being the curator this time? Did you take a different approach a little bit, or what were you trying to do as curator?
Well, I did a little bit of digging into what has been done before. There's always been a very big emphasis on local stuff, which I do think is a very important component. We've brought in composers from the region and that sort of thing. Something that really struck me that I thought would be valuable for our community is to get a deeper sense of the line, which is to say, get a deeper sense for how electronic music began, which is really an offshoot of classical music. In no uncertain terms. I mean, it was created by composers who studied in conservatories and were working with the philosophical and sound-based developmental techniques of their contemporaries, especially in the 1940s.
And you're looking at that beginning coming with just the most rudimentary modulators and things like that, and
right.
Sort of, you know, when the Moog synthesizer came up, that was like the great invention. But you had guys sort of, they were almost like engineer musicians in a way in the beginning.
Yes. And I'll be talking in one of the things that I'll be hosting. It'll be sort of a lecture presentation on the music and thought of Pierre Schaeffer, who was an engineer at a TV studio in France in the mid 40s. And he's the father of tape music. Long before there were synthesizers, people were taking analog tape, recording live sounds, looking for musical elements in those live sounds. For example, a train passing by might have several notes in that sound. And so people like him would go around, record these things with the preliminary recording devices that we had back then, which were really phonographs, and really just splicing bits of tape together painstakingly. A lot of these first pieces were studies in what were the musical parameters found in live recorded sounds, which, you know, in the 50s, John Cage sort of made that famous in a more acoustic setting. But before Cage, there was Schaeffer working on these etudes in Paris and around various parts of Europe. A lot of the really influential European composers that came in two or three decades later, Pierre Boulez, Karlheinz Stockhausen, they all went to his studio to study this with him. And you get a lot of this influence of tape music in their later experiments, which, fair enough, often push people away. But I think it's really interesting to think how common electronic sounds are today, how much we take them for granted, how much we can just take a laptop, which comes prepackaged with GarageBand, and start to make music. You don't have to really know anything. You can just go purely on intuition. And yet before that, in order to get to that point, there were these people laboring away in white lab coats in TV studios in Paris, trying to create music out of spliced tape.
And if I can take you back to Pierre Schaeffer, you said like he would record a train going by. And of course, when a train goes by, you get the Doppler effect. So you get the changed modulation of the sound. So there are different pitches. And he would basically take a recording of that, splice these, say, that train going by into different pitches and create music out of it.
Exactly. He was also looking at the different, more subtle musical parameters that could be implied in a very normal, non-musical event, say a natural slowing down or speeding up, a change in volume, all of the parameters that we musicians think about when we try to be thoughtful in interpretation of a Beethoven piece. These were all elements that were very conscientiously being considered.
So you want to get back to those roots of where electronic music came from. Obviously, the invention of the synthesizer and programmable synthesizers has changed the field dramatically.
It has. We get from the juxtaposition of those two things, one of the most important elements of how culture comes into being, which is some very small-scale sort of fringe behavior little by little becomes more and more ingrained and moves to the center of society and then begins to permeate every aspect of our existence. We almost can't get away from those sounds now, even if we don't think about them as having a classical music beginning, but they absolutely do. And for decades, they were thought about, certainly in the context of poetry and philosophy, even. In the Pierre Schaeffer diaries, you get a lot of reference to Claude Levi-Strauss and the importance of 20th century philosophers on the choices that he was making. And he speaks very poetically about the things that he's passionate about, which is this. It's not, we often think that, you know, it's perhaps some kind of sterile thing, but really there's a lot of passion that goes behind this music and a lot of excitement, which is the reason that it came into being in the first place.
So from the roots, which you'll be talking about in a lecture during the festival, you're going to hear what's happening now. And who are some of the people you wanted to expose to a Tulsa audience that are doing this today?
Well, I think one of the big opportunities that a festival like this affords is the ability to open our community up to, say, another community like in New York. We have another opportunity for cultural exchange. So as much as possible, I think I certainly am interested in trying to breach these boundaries, which really aren't that big of a boundary anymore. It's not that hard to travel. People know what people are doing, but very often the challenge is knowing how to put it all together in an appealing package and create a new fan base. It's not only about appealing to people who are already interested in it, but perhaps even showing people who are already interested in electronic music that it comes from this very rich tradition of thought and experimentation and varying degrees of interest in how the public will react. So something that's very important to me, which is also a very contemporary classical concept, is how to curate the old with the new. So I'm not just trying to move into a different place. I'm really going for a holistic approach. I want to look at sort of an artful curation as much as possible, which perhaps might go without say, but I think that depending on what side of the classical music or popular music spectrum you come from, we tend to put up walls and think that whatever we're involved in tends to be the whole world. And it's a very normal thing. It's normal, I think, for basically anyone who creates anything. And I think the challenge is to remember the connectedness, to remember that in any given field or any given genre, you have a handful of people who are thinking, how can I do something new with this? How can I engage? How can I communicate? How can I be expressive? I think these are often either taboo words in electronic music, or they tend to fall very specifically into specific subgenres. And so we want to kind of tear that away and hopefully create a fan base of friends and members of the community who can appreciate both. They can see the connection to the classical side. They can see artful experimentation in the present. The realization, perhaps, that experimentation doesn't have to be painful for the audience, I think, is a very important topic, whether you're writing with acoustic instruments or electronics. And so because of that, a lot of the emphasis is on electroacoustic music, which is a subgenre that really emphasizes acoustic instruments with electronic components.
And there'll be a session with that featuring some local musicians from not only the Tulsa Symphony, the Signature Symphony, and Tulsa Camerata. They'll be doing a mix.
Exactly.
There'll be an acoustic group with electronic music. Tell us a little bit about some of the things we'll hear in that session. That's on Saturday.
It is. Their set will focus on solo and duo pieces for their particular instrument and some aspect of electronics, which is not explicitly computers or synthesizers or anything like that. We have one piece that deals with looping pedals. We have another piece that deals with video projection and audio playback. David Carter, in fact, will be playing a pretty prominent contemporary composer named Jacob TV, a Dutch composer, who I'm very excited to bring to our community. Not him, of course, but his music. Mm-hmm. Another aspect of contemporary classical music that often gets lost is that a lot of it is actually fun. If we curate intelligently and are thoughtful about the digging process, curation to me is a lot like gold mining. You have to go through a lot of stuff and try to come up with the best thing that you can find. And as it turns out, we're actually in a bit of a golden age right now, I think, for really fun electroacoustic music. We've gone through the experimental phase. There is still some experimentation happening, but a lot of artists are really just interested in writing the pieces they would write, say, for a string quartet or for a solo double bass, and, you know, doing it in a way that is enjoyable.
That communicates to an audience.
Exactly.
I think that's the thing, is you had this period of music, which sort of coincides when electronic music really had its first sort of interest in popularity, was a time when music was being written for sort of this intellectual pursuit, and you had to understand the music to be able to enjoy it, as opposed enjoying it for its own intrinsic worth. You know, there was some sort of journey you had to take to be able to enjoy it. And there was this, you know, this section of music from around 60-something to 70-something where it was very academically oriented. And now composers, whether it's on a commerce side or an artistic side, or usually both, they're making music with the idea that they're going to communicate something to an audience listening to it.
It's directly. True. I think that that is really an important thing for our community to understand, as well as every community. I also think that an interesting thing happens, which is no matter how hard-edged you are about your intentions of what your piece is going to be, at some point the composer goes away. At some point the connotations of the moment go away, and all you're left with is something which can be engaged. And so we don't necessarily want to push away these pieces that came out of that way of thinking either, because sometimes despite themselves, the most expressive pieces arise regardless of the intention of the author. And I think that Pierre Boulez, who is a composer whose readings and pieces I idolized, especially in my graduate studies, if you go at it with an open mind, you can take some really important lessons out of there that you couldn't get anywhere else. He's also a composer who is known for some pretty sublime passages in his music. He studied with Olivier Messiaen, one of the most important composers of the 20th century. And Messiaen, he once said, you know, Pierre, you're a poet if you'd only allow yourself to see it. And we see that a little bit in Boulez's writings as well. I think he'll go down as a contradictory figure, someone known for being very mean-spirited, but also someone who is known for an oxymoronic generosity as well, and someone who experimented a lot, but also could write very appealing music that if you just allow yourself to forget where it comes from, you might actually be able to enjoy it.
My guest today is Noam Feingold. He is a composer, singer, songwriter, and curator for the OK Electric Music Festival, which takes place Friday and Saturday, April 8th and 9th at Living Arts, featuring lectures, listening sessions, and, of course, live music as well. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to get back to something you were talking about earlier. It says, you know, I don't want to ever ascribe an intention for a composer. And I
think it's fun to do, though.
Well, you know, we all do it. but you know, you might be writing it for art's sake. You might be writing it for commerce sake. Or you might be writing it for a combination of both. But the thing with electronic music, sometimes they jump over whatever those reasons are. You know, whether it was commerce, but sometimes it becomes art. And art sometimes becomes commerce. And I'm thinking, like, especially ambient music, which, you know, it's the soundtrack for raves and everything in between, as well as thoughtful listening.
It is. And the kind of festival that I'm interested in is something that's happening already all over the world, which is more of an interest in perhaps previously glossed over relationships between seemingly disconnected fields of practice. I think something that we want to do is to be able to intelligently curate a rave side by side with a lecture. And that's not so much an experiment. It perhaps sounds kind of crazy to someone who's never engaged with a successful festival or performance that has done these things, but this is definitely the way things are being thought about in Berlin and London and New York right now. I have attended concerts. There's a series in London and Berlin called Yellow Lounge, where really important concert soloists like Hilary Hahn will improvise to prepared piano with a guest, as opposed to, say, playing Schoenberg Concerto or the Bach suites or anything like that. And this is done in sort of a dark nightclub atmosphere where people are standing up. There's an open bar, and this will be paired with maybe minimalist electronic music as well. I believe on that bill, it was actually Eric Whitaker conducting his choir.
Oh, yeah.
So you have some very interesting side experiments happening by these established concert performers that, you know, we would bring them here perhaps to play with the symphony and have the expectation that that's everything that's supposed to happen. But at the same time, the great performers and the great artists, they always have these very complex lives of interest and side endeavors that they're not so much experiments as, I think, an attempt to satiate some other aspect of their artistic life that isn't being met by the traditional repertoire.
Well, speaking of satiating your artistic desires, I want to talk about one of the sessions you're going to be doing, which is involved with a lap steel and guitar player, Chris Combs. You guys are going to be creating improvised film scores during this. Talk about this. What's going to happen on this?
I'm very excited about that. So we can engage with film, I think, in an intelligent way in this, because obviously film is electronic technology, and yet obviously everybody loves it as well. And so that can become an interesting place to do some exploration. Maybe exploration is a better word than experimentation for a lot of things. It feels a little safer, but we might still generate some new and interesting outcomes and enjoyable performances for our audiences. So I asked Chris to kind of sketch out some preliminary material to be performed live accompanying silent films from the turn of the century. So this is a time period where this is how film music was being written. They would just take fragments from the classical music repertoire, or say right around 1910, they would compile these books of different moods and different textures that they thought might best suit a certain dramatic situation. I know that we'll be doing The Great Train Robbery and films by Georges Méliès, one of the first real, fully narrative film makers. And he's also one of the first filmmakers to commission film scores, actually. So we start to have these interesting overlaps as the technology is really getting set up and the way of doing things is set up. So Chris will come up with some music, and then half of it will be improvised on the spot, sort of as a new version, a new take on that old way of doing things.
And if you think of the old theater organ, you mentioned, they say they would give you an excerpt from, say, Beethoven or Wagner as a possible accompaniment. The organist would use that theme, and then they would improvise on that for the extent of that scene. Or in the case of this French filmmaker you made, he was actually commissioning a film score that would be played live.
Right. And a lot of times, because of the difficulty in getting things across the Atlantic Ocean, for example, some of these film scores were lost. We don't have the originals. If you go on YouTube, you can find a lot of people's senior composition projects being writing film scores to these films. For example, we'll be doing A Trip to the Moon, which is a very famous film as well.
Right.
And what you can really see there is, because it's silent film, you don't have sound dialogue to react to. You can really go in any direction with these things. But really what appealed to me about Chris and the group that he put together is his relationship to both composed music and jazz. We worked together on Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey's Beethoven project at OK Mozart in 2010. I was the orchestrator on that project. And so we already have a history of this half improvised, half written out approach to the repertoire that has one foot in the past. So for people who are interested in that sort of a thing, I think that they'll be very pleasantly surprised by how enjoyable this aspect of the festival will be.
Yeah, and that takes place Friday evening at 9 o'clock. The OK Electric Music Festival takes place Friday and Saturday, April 8th and 9th at Living Arts, featuring a variety of live music situations, listening sessions, and lectures by my guest today, among others, the curator, Noam Feingold. And I want to change gears here for a moment and talk about your recent recording, the Burning City Orchestra. This is very interesting. You were talking about don't put music into sort of these little boxes that everybody loves to put music in. And what's really interesting is I could see this as like 21st century acoustic electric art music. I could see it as a really cool singer-songwriter project, or about four or five spots along the spectrum. Tell us a little bit about this recording.
Well, it's funny you should mention the different interpretations you could have with it. I think about it first and foremost as rock orchestra music. Now, unfortunately for me, perhaps, that already kind of exists as a sound that people have a preliminary association with. And I really am in love with that sound. But something that I was trying to do with this record and with this band, because it's a group that plays these pieces that I've written, is to actually try to do justice to all of the sounding elements involved. The typical relationship between string players and a singer-songwriter is, stand up there and look cool, or play these long notes, maybe highlight the harmony a little bit. Really what I was looking for was something that can't typically be done unless you're extremely involved in both worlds all the time, which is really chamber music in the strings and piano. I was thinking about it in terms of the place that classical art song, jazz standard, and pop song all sort of intertwine.
Yeah.
So the lyrics are very important to me. I chose very carefully among all the lyrics that I had written that also have, I think, the most appealing material musically. But, I'm primarily a melodic composer. And so there's a lot of melody here, but I'm also interested in expressiveness. I'm interested in Beethoven, but I'm also interested in contemporary classical music. And so depending on the dramatic content of the lyrics, we get sort of these different sound worlds, but hopefully our fans will agree that there is a cohesiveness, that there's sort of an ebb and flow and a tension and release between these different string sounds and the piano. I was actually very fortunate to have some guest artists on this album, including Timothy Andries, who is a pianist and composer. He tours around the world a lot, is on the Nonesuch label. He agreed to play piano on my album. And Reed Mathis, the Tolson previous member of Jacob Fred Jazz Odyssey and current member of Tea Leaf Green and various other projects, he came in and did some soloing on his electric bass. He has a very unique sound that makes it almost sound like an electric violin on one of the songs on Dirge in the Rain.
Right, I was listening to it. It almost sounded like an electric guitar, with little effects on it. And it was him, actually. It was really cool. Let's hear some music from the recording. I'm going to play All in My Mind, which I think has got this wonderful melodic hook, but it also shows off everything you've been talking about really well. Let's hear music from the Burning City Orchestra.
Sounds good.
Foot stomping down and the violin sound crescendos with me as I fly in the islands below. Catch my eye, I can barely make out their reply. But the island I've seen all my life was just all in my mind. My biggest regret is that I have to leave all my problems behind. Her face in the dark, my chaperones as I catch my flight. The party trails off to a trickle of laughs. I can feel the sweet sadness relight. And what's left in her face in my mind is a sigh that remains. Just long enough to fit in my name in the breath she
That's music by my guest today, Noam Feingold and his group, the Burning City Orchestra. I should say you're a collective, but it's your writing, really. And you've been involved with this for a long time. You had a UK incarnation when you were studying in London, and from another group, and they're all from New York, I guess, where you also studied.
They are. The interesting history of this group is actually that I started writing some of these first songs here in Tulsa. Mm-hmm. The very first incarnation happened when I was a student at the University of Tulsa, and it featured string players from the University of Tulsa School of Music. And then I ended up making a demo and sent that off to the BBC for this worldwide competition that they had, and we ended up getting in the 20th spot out of something like 2,000 from around the world, from 88 countries. So I think that told me that was something I should keep going with. Anushka Shankar gave me a lot of compliments on it, so it's kind of hard to turn away from this project, and I felt I had to see it through. So when I moved to New York to go to grad school, I started the group again. And really, the people that I recorded this album with are the people that I did my master's with, that we've been playing together for 7 or 8 years now, really. We've played various gigs together.
Yeah, played last month somewhere, right?
I was in New York playing at a bar there. But, you know, these are also people that I'm a classical orchestral bassist as well, and I've played in orchestra with, you know, these friends of mine. So, you know, these are men and women who are playing sort of all over the place. I think our bass player is now with the American Symphony Orchestra. He also has various groups that are involved with the Mata Festival. They play at Carnegie. They're quite an amazing group of people. And it's always the same group. I try to really just make music with my friends here. Something that's really sorely missing, I think, is this sort of more chamber ensemble or group model or band model, which is something that I was going for that you don't see very often.
Well, you don't see it often in the classical world.
Right.
I think that would be a great thing that, I mean, I know there's some groups here in Tulsa Camerata is doing that a little bit. And it'd be good to see more folks doing like that, where they just come together for projects.
Yeah. Sometimes we venture outside of it's hard to call this mainstream music. It feels mainstream to me, but we've also done some of the challenging 20th century repertoire together. I remember when we were at grad school in NYU, we did Webern's 5 pieces for string quartet, and I conducted it with them. And it was all the same players you hear on this record. We've also done some of Louis Andriessen's music.
Mm-hmm. Well, we wish you great success with that. Noam, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Composer and performer Noam Feingold speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His self-titled album, which came out last fall, is titled Burning City Orchestra, and he'll be serving as curator for Living Arts of Tulsa's OK Electric Music Festival coming up this Friday and Saturday at Living Arts at 307 East Brady. Details at livingarts.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.